Nearly 14,000 books have been written about Abraham Lincoln, but none until Andrew Ferguson's latest that examine how Lincoln's legacy continues to shape America today. Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America is published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Andrew Ferguson to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So how much do Americans actually agree on what Abraham Lincoln represents? Should I assume that many Southerners have a very different view of him than people in other parts of the country?
Well, that's just one example. You know, one of the things that started me on this book was, even though I'd grown up as a Lincoln buff as a kid in Illinois, Lincoln used to sort of hover over the country as this big unitary presence, this kind of unified national icon.
The greatest president we ever had.
And sort of, you know, woven into the country, as it were. And I just noticed over the last generation or so that he seemed to have shrunk a little bit, almost fragmented into dozens of different Lincolns, so that everybody kind of had his own cut-to-fit Lincoln.
So the South, we understand, there are still some people who are unreconstructed, but is there a different Lincoln in the Midwest, a different one in the Southwest, a different one in the Northwest?
I don't know if it's divided by region so much as almost personal temperament. You know, you see it in the books that have been published over the last couple of years. We've had a book proving that Lincoln was a fundamentalist Christian, and that was written by a fundamentalist Christian. We've had a book proving that his greatness lay in his struggle with clinical depression, which was written by a guy who's struggled with clinical depression. Of course, most famously, there was the gay Lincoln book written by, of course, a homosexual activist.
People are claiming him as their own.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I found one book not long ago where it proved that if Lincoln were alive today, his political opinions would be the same as Mario Cuomo's. Of course, we know who wrote that book.
But there's also the Lincoln who felt that blacks were inferior and because of other political considerations, got drawn into coming up with the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, and that, I think, is, ironically enough, often the Southern view. A lot of the neo-Confederates, I guess you would call them, that I deal with in the book, who I met down in Richmond, former capital of the Confederacy, actually have kind of turned the tables and accuse Lincoln of being the things that people would usually accuse the neo-Confederates of being. So Lincoln is kind of a racist, a right-wing demagogue, and so on.
Well, you said that you were a Lincoln buff when you were a child. What drew you to him rather than, let's say, collecting stamps, learning guitar, or playing Little League baseball? Was it because it was Illinois?
Well, it was partly Illinois, but, you know, I found this around the country, especially as I travel around now, and both doing the book and later, that there were buffs of that vintage all over the country. I mean, whether in New York or California or the Pacific Northwest. And there are so many avenues into Lincoln. You know, this, I think, is one of the reasons we see him having fragmented so much. If you're interested in political philosophy, well, Lincoln is a giant in political philosophy. If you're interested, as I was, in literature and beautiful prose and writing, well, Lincoln was the greatest of our prose stylists. If you're interested in war and history and military history in particular, well, he was our greatest wartime president. So there's really almost 1,000 different avenues into this vast figure of Lincoln.
But it's interesting that people are constantly trying to cut him down to size in the same way that they went after Thomas Jefferson. Well, Jefferson was perhaps a lot more vulnerable than Lincoln, but Lincoln was just a man, and I'm sure that he had many bad sides and bad days anyway.
And, you know, there's a kind of immediacy to him that almost resists the debunking that you've seen in Jefferson, for example. We feel, at least I've had this sense, that we feel that we know Lincoln in a way that we don't, say, George Washington with that stiff view, or even Jefferson now stalking the slave quarters at night. There's partly this is because he was one of the first American presidents, or the first American president to be photographed routinely, and Lincoln was very conscious of his image, and he never passed up a chance to have his photograph made, and he realized that made him live for people in a way that other more remote politicians of the time didn't. And we're still the beneficiaries of that today, this his own acute sense of what public relations was like.
Do you think he would be such a national icon if he hadn't been assassinated, if he hadn't
been martyred? No, you know, it's really one of the things that touches off the entire Lincoln phenomenon. He was in Ford's Theater on Good Friday, was assassinated, then died the next morning, Holy Saturday morning. By the next day, Easter, everyone in the country knew about it, and the preachers mounted their pulpits and immediately drew the parallels to Jesus, that he had been dead 3 days. One died to save humanity, one died to save the Union, and so on. And from there, with this kind of slingshot effect, it sort of sent Lincoln into the stratosphere in a way that he wouldn't have achieved otherwise.
Well, it's interesting that we've had four assassinated presidents, and two became superhuman, Lincoln the most, JFK to a lesser degree, but still. And then the other two, William McKinley and James Garfield, nobody really thinks much about them.
Right. And, you know, if you go back, though, you see that in the years immediately following the death of McKinley and Garfield, there was this same kind of effort to turn them into gods and almost martyrs. It didn't work for them, and it's a very revealing reason why, which is that Lincoln's substantial impact on the country was so definitive and lingers to this day that that's how I could write a book like The Land of Lincoln. I couldn't have written The Land of Garfield or The Land of McKinley. You go anywhere in the country today, you will find places where he is an immediate, almost thriving presence.
And there are cities and towns named Lincoln all over the country, a lot more than Garfield. You write about a huge trade in artifacts surrounding Lincoln and his assassination, and quote a letter from a soldier named Willie Clark to his sister. Should I read it, or at least the part?
Sure.
"Enclosed, you will find a piece of lace Mrs. Lincoln wore on her head during the evening and was dropped by her while entering my room to see her dying husband. It's worth keeping for its historical value." And then it goes on, "I have a lock of Mr. Lincoln's hair, which I have neatly framed. Also, a piece of linen with a portion of his brain."
Yeah. Well, these were Victorians, you remember, and they had a kind of a mawkish sense of what was fitting. Willie Clark was the unlucky or lucky young boy who lived in the rooming house across the street from Ford's Theater, where Lincoln's body was carried immediately after he was shot and where Lincoln died. And, you know, we talked about this slingshot effect of Lincoln's immediate martyrdom. Well, Lincoln commerce began immediately, too. And there's a good deal in this book about the odd juxtaposition of Lincoln the martyr and Lincoln the gold mine, as it were. For example, Willie Clark himself was there, and as Lincoln bled in his bed, they had to change the bed linens every few minutes because he was bleeding profusely, and Mrs. Lincoln would come in every 30 minutes or so to see her husband as he slowly faded away, and they would take these soiled sheets and chuck them out the window of the Peterson housing, the Peterson boarding house, and outside in the alleyway were groups of ghouls, I guess you'd call them now, but actually they were quite smart tradesmen, who would gather up these soiled sheets, and by the time Lincoln died at 7 in the morning the next day, there were vendors out on the street selling little square inches of the soiled sheets.
My guest is Andrew Ferguson, a senior editor at the Weekly Standard, who's written for the New Yorker, the New Republic, the Washington Post, Fortune, Time, and other publications. Now written a book called Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. And you live in Virginia. Wasn't it something that happened in Richmond, Virginia, that got you back with Lincoln? You had been a buff and then sort of drifted away for a while.
The way a lot of us do, I think, from our childhood enthusiasm. Yeah, I picked up the paper one morning a couple of years ago, and there was a headline that said, Lincoln's statue stirs outrage in Richmond. And, you know, the words Lincoln and outrage you don't expect to see in the same sentence. But sure enough, the city fathers down in Richmond, Virginia, had decided to place on public property a statue of Abraham Lincoln, the first one actually in the old Confederacy.
Well, it was also the capital of the Confederacy.
Yeah, Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy and still is, I think, by some lights of people down there.
Is there a Jefferson Davis statue in Richmond?
Oh, yeah, they're all over the place, actually. I mean, and they're not even statues. They're almost like memorials, and they take up city blocks, in fact. But so anyway, I thought, well, I ought to go down and see why these people are so outraged about it, because there were traffic stoppages and letter writing campaigns and websites put up to try and keep this the statue from going in, and it was a huge controversy. And I'll tell you something that happened to me was I went down there. The anti-Lincoln people put on what they called a scholarly conference to examine Lincoln's legacy, and the pro-Lincoln people put on their own scholarly conference. I went down to the anti-Lincoln one first, and, you know, these guys were not idiots. They knew a lot. In fact, I was shamed to see that they knew a lot more about Lincoln than I did, and I was the former buff. And they had read very deeply, although not widely, in the literature of the Civil War and Lincoln's life. And I was kind of shook up by that. I thought, you know, these guys hate him with a passion that you seldom see about historical subjects anymore. So I went to the pro-Lincoln conference, and I thought, well, you know, these guys will fortify my belief in Lincoln's greatness. And it was awful. Because it was almost as though they couldn't tell you why Lincoln was great. They kind of assumed it. So they would come up with things like, well, you know, Lincoln was very tolerant of ambiguity. He was very non-judgmental. He was nice to his kids. You know, and I thought, well, now, wait a minute.
Loved his wife.
Yeah, right. You know, one thing we do know about Lincoln is he prosecuted one of the bloodiest wars in American history. So surely there's got to be more to him than that. But it was almost as though we'd lost the language of his greatness. We didn't even know how to express what he had done for the country.
Well, he had been hated during his lifetime by Americans all over. And New York City's mayor and city council voted to secede from the Union until the Confederacy fired on Fort Sumter, and then it didn't seem like a very patriotic thing to do. And after he was assassinated, some of his most outspoken opponents said some of the kindest words about him. So
oh, sure.
It was all the assassination.
Sure. Henry Beecher across the river here had been spending 4 years from his pulpit talking about Lincoln's cowardice and his sort of lame response to the terrible insurrection and his timidity and so on, because he refused to free the slaves all at once and for other reasons. The moment Lincoln was dead, however, things really began looking up for him.
You tell the story of a white supremacist named James K. Vardaman, who made a pilgrimage to Springfield, Illinois in the late 60s, the centennial of Lincoln's death.
Well, this is actually the turn of the century. He was the great spokesman of white supremacy, for a senator from Mississippi who went in every year would lay a wreath at the Lincoln Memorial, because he said Lincoln's views about race and mine were substantially the same. It's another example of how we, you know, this idea of sort of cutting to fit Lincoln, have him fit our own prejudices, is really quite an old phenomenon. You know, here in New York back in the 30s, there was Lincoln-Lenin Day that the American Communist Party would celebrate.
And of course, there was the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, sure, during the Spanish Civil War. Do you think that the reason that many people in the South refuse to honor Lincoln is that they still hold on to some of the sentiments of the Civil War, and they would see it as a kind of an insult to all the Confederate dead to honor Lincoln?
That's part of it. And you know, there are good things and bad things about this
Lincoln. I mean, isn't it time for them to accept the fact that they lost the Civil War and that the United States is a unified country?
Yes, in fact,
they actually won the Civil War, if you look at the way Congress is being run these days.
Well, yeah, I don't know how happy
they'd be. And how many presidents we've had from the South in recent years?
This is all true, but their reality is not their number one subject, actually. But there are good things and bad things about this Lincoln passion, especially among the Lincoln haters, the Southerners. The bad part is obvious. You know, it's entangled with racism quite often and so on, white supremacy. The good part is that people feel history. History lives for them, and they feel themselves part of a long continuum that passes through time, and they feel themselves attached to the past. Now, we're supposedly a people in a country famously indifferent to history, and I actually find this quite admirable, that people can still draw from the past some kind of sustaining influences.
Although the Civil War is a special case. That's why we have the reenactors and all of those people who go to all the battlefields in a way that they would never do for the American Revolution.
Yes, it's the thing we can't get over.
There's an Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Not like the Nixon Library or the Kennedy Library.
No, hardly. This actually just went up in the last couple of years. You know, Springfield, which is his hometown where he lived for most of his adult life, has always had an eye out for how to make Lincoln pay. In fact, the day after Lincoln died, The city fathers went out to the intersection of two rail lines and tried to buy up all the property so they could make a memorial to Lincoln there and bury him, so that as train passengers went through town, they would look out the window and see this vast memorial and maybe want to get out and spend the night in a hotel and buy some food in a restaurant and maybe buy some knickknacks and so on. They've always had an eye for the main chance down there in Springfield.
But then they decided that it might be a good idea to build a roller coaster to represent Lincoln's mood swings.
Right. Well, this is one of the ideas they pitched. What they did with, and this is how, you know, this book, which is Land of Lincoln, which is about Lincoln, is also about America and our times. Instead of finding a great plot to bury him now, the city fathers of Springfield went to Disney and said, hey, how can we build a museum that will really draw people in? They eventually didn't hire Disney itself, but they hired a man who used to work for Disney who came up with all kinds of ideas, one of which is this crazy thing about the roller coaster, because Lincoln was bipolar. You could have the ups and the downs and so on and so forth. That was quickly dispensed with. But he did come up with a museum that is designed to tug at your heartstrings, to make you laugh and cry, and maybe teach a little history along the way, although I think that's dubious.
But there is so much vulgarization here. There's even Association of Lincoln Presenters.
Yes, right.
People who do the Lincoln things and
This is a guy. This is a group of people who actually make a living imitating Abraham Lincoln. And I went out. They had an annual conference, and this year they had it in Santa's Lodge in Santa Claus, Indiana. And I said, "Thank you, God. Yes, you are being very nice to me today." So I went out to Santa Claus, walked into Santa's Lodge, which is the only motel there, and there were 75 guys staring back at me dressed exactly like Abraham Lincoln in stovepipe hats.
Only Elvis gets that kind of adoration.
Yeah, actually, I think Elvis imitators is a little more lucrative.
Andrew Ferguson's book, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America, is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been
thank you
a lot
for
of fun.
Having me. It's been a pleasure.